These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled The Odyssey of Homer. The lecturer is Professor Elizabeth Vandiver. Dr. Vandiver teaches classics at the University of Maryland at College Park. After receiving her MA and PhD from the University of Texas at Austin, she held visiting professorships at Northwestern University, the University of Georgia, the Intercollegiate Center for Classical Studies in Rome, and Loyola University of New Orleans. Professor Vandiver is the author of Heroes in Herodotus, The Interaction of Myth and History. In 1998, Dr. Vandiver received the American Philological Association's Excellence in Teaching Award, the most prestigious teaching award available to American classical scholars. Her other awards include the Northwestern University Department of Classics Excellence in Teaching Award and two University of Georgia Outstanding Honors Professor Awards. Professor Vandiver prepared the course guide that comes with these lectures. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, timeline, and bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1, Introduction to Homeric Epic.
Hello, and welcome to Homeric Epic, The Odyssey. My name is Elizabeth Vandiver. I teach classics at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, and I'll be talking to you for the next several hours about Homer's great epic, The Odyssey. In this first lecture, we'll begin with an overview of the events in the traditional Trojan War story that took place after the end of the Iliad, but before the opening of the Odyssey, since the Odyssey assumes that its audience is completely familiar not only with the Iliad, but also with the intervening events that happened between the end of the Iliad and the beginning of the Odyssey. After this overview of the background story, we'll move on to a discussion of the difference between epics which focus on glory and warfare, such as the Iliad, and epics that focus on homecoming, nostos in Greek, of which the Odyssey is our main example. We'll then turn to an examination of the structure of the Odyssey itself and discuss its very complicated chronological arrangement. The lecture will conclude by considering the overall effect of the delay in Odysseus's appearance in the Odyssey, since he does not appear until book 5 of the epic. Now, just as a knowledge of the death of Achilles and the destruction of Troy are essential for a full understanding of the Iliad, even though those events are not narrated in the Iliad itself, so a knowledge of the subsequent events, the fall of Troy, the events that happened during the fall of Troy, the adventures of other heroes other than Odysseus on their way home, those episodes are essential for an understanding and appreciation of the Odyssey. The events that took place between the end of the Iliad and the opening of the Odyssey were recounted in several epics that are no longer extant, several shorter works than the Iliad and the Odyssey that have not survived from antiquity up until the present day. We do have summaries of those now lost epics, and so we know what they said and what events they narrated. Now, I should say that these epics, the no longer existing epics, were not by any means as great or as long as the Iliad and the Odyssey. Already in antiquity, it was recognized that these intermediate epics, the ones that narrated the intermediate events, were of much lower quality and much less impressive than the Iliad and the Odyssey. Still, it's a shame that they've disappeared. It would be nice to still have them, but we don't. We do know their titles, how long each one was, and what they talked about. The first epic in this so-called epic cycle, picked up right after the events of the Iliad. It was called the Aethiopis. It was five books long. That is, it took five average-sized papyrus scrolls to write out the Aethiopis, as opposed to the 24 scrolls required for the Iliad or the Odyssey. So you can see how much shorter this secondary epic was. It picked up the action immediately after the funeral of Hector, and it told of Achilles' death. Achilles died when he was shot in the heel by Paris. Paris, the Trojan prince who had abducted Helen and thereby started the Trojan War. The next epic in the epic cycle was called the Little Iliad. It was four books long, and it narrated the after effects of Achilles' death and the sack of Troy itself. The two main episodes that are important for understanding the Odyssey, which appeared in the Little Iliad, were the story of how Aias the Greater, the second greatest warrior, second only to Achilles himself among the Greeks, committed suicide after the Greeks had voted to award the armor of Achilles, not to Aias, but to Odysseus. There was a question after Achilles' death, who should be given his magnificent armor, which had been made for him by the god Hephaestus himself. The Greeks voted on this question of who should get the armor. And by awarding the armor to Odysseus, in effect, they said that they prized cunning, intelligence, craftiness, all of Odysseus's qualities above sheer prowess in battle, which was Aias's main strength. And Aias, in shame and outrage over this affront, as he saw it, to his honor, committed suicide. The Little Iliad also narrated the story of how the Greeks finally built the great wooden horse, which allowed them to infiltrate the walls of Troy and sack Troy by night. And of course, the wooden horse was the idea of none other than Odysseus himself. He invented it. He thought it up. So the Little Iliad told of the suicide of Aias and the building of the wooden horse. The next epic in the epic cycle, called the Iliupersis, which simply means the sack of Ilium or the sack of Troy, was only two books long. It overlapped a bit with the Little Iliad in telling the story of the sack of Troy. Most importantly for our purposes in understanding the Odyssey, the Iliupersis narrated several outrages, several acts of excessive violence that the Greeks committed during the sack of Troy. Three in particular are worth mentioning. The Greeks threw Hector's baby son Astyanax from the walls of Troy and killed him. Achilles' son Neoptolemus killed King Priam, the old king of Troy, at Priam's household altar where Priam had gone for refuge. By going to the altar in his house and putting his hands on it, Priam was, in some sense, under the protection of the gods. And so to kill him there was a kind of sacrilege against the gods. But Achilles' son Neoptolemus committed this sacrilege and killed Priam at his own household altar. Finally, Aias the Lesser, there are two heroes named Aias. Aias the Greater committed suicide. Aias the Lesser was guilty of perhaps the worst sacrilege of all in the sack of Troy. He raped Priam's daughter Cassandra, who had taken refuge in the temple of the virgin goddess Athena. Aias dragged her away from Athena's statue and raped her in the temple, which is a violation and a sacrilege in all sorts of ways. The fact that he did this in a temple, the fact that Cassandra had taken refuge at the statue of a virgin goddess, all of these add to the sacrilege of the act. Now, in the fourth epic that filled the gap between the Iliad and the Odyssey, the so-called Nostoi, or Returns, Homecomings or Returns, which was an epic five books long, the story was told of the homecomings of the Greek warriors other than Odysseus. And because of the acts of sacrilege that the Greeks had committed during the sack of Troy, most of them either did not make it home or had trouble on their way home. Most importantly, for our purposes, Agamemnon, the leader of the Greek expedition, made it home from Troy, but was killed when he arrived home by his wife Clytemnestra and her lover Aegisthus. Menelaus and Helen and her original husband Menelaus, wandered for 7 years, spent several of those years in Egypt, only made it home from Troy in the eighth year after the sack of Troy. Aias the Lesser, by the way, was killed at sea because of his sacrilege in raping Cassandra. So the outrages that the Greeks committed during the sack of Troy in some degree, motivated the troubles they had on their way home. Now, as I said, this last intermediate epic was called Nostoi, which means homecoming or returns. And the singular of that in Greek is Nostos. Nostos, homecoming, is obviously the main theme of the Odyssey, just as the concept of imperishable glory, kleos in Greek, was one of the main themes of the Iliad. In fact, some scholars say that ancient epic can be divided into kleos epic and nostos epic, into epic about glory and warfare and epic about adventures and troubles during homecoming. That these were the two main subgenres, if you will, of ancient epic in the bardic tradition. I think perhaps an equally valid distinction would be to say that we can divide epic into war epic and peace epic, because kleos, glory, what people say about you, your reputation, is still very important in the Odyssey, as we'll see in some key scenes. Odysseus and other characters are still concerned with their kleos, with what people say about them, with whether their exploits are known or not. The difference is that while in the Iliad, kleos is seen as the only kind of meaningful immortality a warrior can seek, what people will say about him after his death, in the Odyssey, there's less of a focus on kleos as immortality after death and more of a focus on maintaining your reputation, keeping your kleos alive while you are yourself alive. The focus is simply different, because in the Odyssey, we're not thinking about war and the very likely death in battle of any given hero. Rather, we're looking at the aftermath of war and Odysseus's attempt to return home. So, as I said, I think that perhaps a distinction between war epic and peace epic is as valid as a distinction between kleos epic and nostos epic, or perhaps it's just another way of saying the same thing. Like the Iliad, the Odyssey begins in medias res, in the middle of its subject matter. Because we're dealing with an epic here that was composed in an oral tradition by a bard working in an oral tradition, the bard is able to start the story anywhere he likes. The first thing he does is run through a little introduction, proem, as it's usually called, in which he sets the scene. He announces to the audience who it is that he's going to sing about or what it is that he's going to sing about. He very rapidly gives a little summary of what's happened leading up to the point where he'll begin his story, and he focuses in on exactly where he wants his story to begin. The first 10 lines of the Odyssey, then, are, in English, as follows. Tell me, Muse, of the man of many ways, who was driven far journeys after he had sacked Troy's sacred citadel. Many were they whose cities he saw, whose minds he learned of, many the pains he suffered in his spirit on the wide sea, struggling for his own life and the homecoming of his companions. Even so, he could not save his companions, hard though he strove to. They were destroyed by their own wild recklessness, fools who devoured the oxen of Helios, the sun god, and he took away the day of their homecoming. From some point, here, goddess, daughter of Zeus, speak and begin our story. Now, there's several points I want to bring out about that proem, about that opening. First of all, the bard runs through a brief resume of Odysseus's adventures in those opening lines. He gives Odysseus credit for sacking Troy. That's got to be a reference to the Trojan horse. It was Odysseus's cleverness, his cunning, his thinking up the stratagem of the Trojan horse that allowed Troy to be sacked. So we're talking about the man who sacked Troy, who then was driven far journeys, who saw many different people, who suffered a great deal. And notice the stress on homecoming. He was trying to bring about the homecoming, not just of himself, but of his companions. Now, right away in these opening lines of the Odyssey, there is an attempt on the bard's part, and we'll see this again on Odysseus's own part, to get around an inherent problem in the story of the Odyssey. The Odyssey is Odysseus's story. For it to have full narrative power, we need to see him absolutely alone, coming home absolutely alone, having lost all his companions. And yet Odysseus is a leader. He took these men of Ithaca, his home island, off to Troy with him. He's the only one who makes it back alive. This is not exactly indicative of good leadership or of what you would expect from a fine, clever warrior and leader. There's got to be some way to explain how Odysseus could have lost all his men without making Odysseus seem blameworthy. And right in these very opening lines, the bard addresses that. Odysseus was striving for his companions' homecoming, but they, fools that they were destroyed by their own recklessness. This is a theme that will be returned to many times in the Odyssey, the fact that Odysseus tried to bring his companions home, but they were destroyed by their own mistakes, their own foolishness. Secondly, you may have noticed that Odysseus is not named in the proem of the Odyssey. Unlike the first line of the Iliad, where the bard says, "Muse, goddess, sing the wrath of Peleus's son Achilles," the name Odysseus does not occur until line 21 of the Odyssey. And yet, Odysseus is established as the subject of the Odyssey, not just in the first few lines of the proem, where we're told that this was the man who sacked Troy, but actually in the very first line, because Odysseus is described in the first line of the Odyssey by the epithet, the essential adjective, polutropos. This is not his most common epithet in the Odyssey, but it is one of his most important epithets. The word polutropos is utterly untranslatable into one English word. I can tell you what it means. I can't come up with a good one-word translation for it. It means literally, many turns. Polu means many, as in words like polygon, any other word that has poly, P-O-L-Y or P-O-L-U in it. That means many in Greek. Tropos means turns, turn or turning. So the polutropos man is the man of many turnings. Now, what does that mean for Odysseus? I think there are two levels of meaning in this word. First off, he is literally a man of many turnings. He is blown back and forth on the sea, trying to get home to Ithaca. He keeps being turned off course. He keeps being blown back in the direction he's already come from. So literally, this word refers to his many wanderings. But it also refers to his cleverness. He is polutropos in his mind. He is able to think his way out of any situation, to think on his feet, to reason his way out of troubles, to come up with stratagems, clever ploys to get himself out of any difficulty. And the word polutropos picks up on both of those aspects of Odysseus's story, his wanderings and his cleverness. It's a very difficult challenge for a translator. Right there in the center of the first line of the Odyssey is this word that is thematically of the utmost importance for the Odyssey and can't be translated into one good English word or even one good English phrase. Our translator here gives the man of many ways, which is nicely ambiguous, but maybe a little too ambiguous, doesn't quite get the punch of polutropos across. The very first word of the Odyssey is andra, which means the man. So the first line of the Odyssey begins with the word man, just as the first line of the Iliad begins with the word wrath or anger. The first word of each of these poems sets its tone. From the instant you hear the opening word of the Iliad, you know that you're going to hear about anger, wrath, a great quarrel. From the instant you hear the opening word of the Odyssey, you know that you're going to hear about one man, one individual, and his adventures. And of course, the Odyssey is, first and foremost, about Odysseus's struggles to get home. The first 13 lines, I read you the first 10, the first 13 lines include the word nostos, homecoming or return, or a derivative of it, no less than three times in just 13 lines. In line 5, already he's longing for or striving for the nostos of his companions. In line 9, we're told that the sun god takes away his companions' nostimon amar, the day of their homecoming, the day of their nostos. In line 13, which I did not read to you, but perhaps most importantly of all, we're told that Odysseus is longing for his nostos and for his wife, the two things that he wants, the two things he's striving to regain in the Odyssey, his homecoming and his wife Penelope. So very clearly from the opening of the Odyssey, the idea that this is the story of Odysseus's struggle for his nostos is set up right from the very beginning. After identifying Odysseus, By summarizing his adventures, the bard asks the muse to start the story from some point. As I already said, a bard working in the oral tradition can pick up the story anywhere he wants to. We've been told we're going to talk about Odysseus. We're going to hear a story of Odysseus's attempt to return home. But where is that story going to start? It could start anywhere. It could start right after the sack of Troy. It could start the day before Odysseus arrives back on Ithaca. Anywhere in that whole 10-year time period that he spent trying to get from Troy to Ithaca, the story could start. Our bard says to the goddess, to the muse of poetry, the muse who inspires him with the story, pick it up at some point, from some point, begin the story. The bard then implies that the Odyssey will start in the 10th year after the Trojan War. He very quickly runs through a little resume of what's happened to everybody else and to Odysseus. He tells us that the other heroes have all either made it home or died. Everyone who didn't die at Troy or get shipwrecked at sea is now home again. Only Odysseus is still missing. And the bard tells us that Odysseus is being held prisoner by a nymph or a goddess named Calypso on her island in the middle of the sea. As the Odyssey opens, we're still within the first 30 lines here, Athena, the virgin goddess who will, as we'll see in the Odyssey, is Odysseus's primary patron deity, Athena beseeches the great god Zeus, the king of the gods, to send the messenger god Hermes to tell Calypso that she must let Odysseus go. So it seems as though we're going to start right at the point where Odysseus is freed from his 7 years captivity on Calypso's island and is allowed to go home to Ithaca. Athena says to Zeus, send Hermes to tell Calypso she must let Odysseus go. But then, after giving us this false lead, in effect, this belief that we're going to immediately go to Calypso's island and see Odysseus there and move on to Ithaca, the bard suddenly changes direction and goes off on a side story. Athena says that while Zeus is sending Hermes to tell Calypso it's time to let Odysseus go, she, Athena, will go to Odysseus's home island of Ithaca and visit his son there. And so we suddenly take this detour. We go off to Ithaca and spend the first four books of the Odyssey, and that would be about 4 hours of performance time, not with Odysseus at all, but rather following the adventures of his son, Telemachus. Odysseus only shows up in person in the Odyssey in book five. So the narrative structure of the Odyssey, already from this beginning point, is extremely complicated and anything but straightforward. As I just said, the first four books of the Odyssey are concerned primarily not with Odysseus at all, but with his son Telemachus. In books one and two of the Odyssey, we see Telemachus at home on his island of Ithaca. In books three and four of the Odyssey, we see Telemachus traveling to visit Nestor and Menelaus, two of Odysseus's old comrades in arms, two characters from the Iliad. So the first four books are taken up with Telemachus. Books five through eight introduce us to Odysseus himself and take up his story as he leaves Calypso's island, journeys to the land of a people called the Phaeacians, who will show him great hospitality and help him on his homeward journey. So you would expect then after book eight, if the Phaeacians are going to help Odysseus home, book nine should take him to Ithaca, right? Well, it doesn't. Books 9 through 12, the heart of the Odyssey, the most famous section of the Odyssey, are actually a flashback section in which Odysseus narrates in the first person his adventures from leaving Troy up to arriving at Calypso's island. Then finally, in book 13, the bard changes to a straightforward chronological sequence, and books 13 through 24 show us Odysseus's homecoming to Ithaca all the way through his killing of the suitors of his wife Penelope and regaining of his status and power in Ithaca. So a purely chronological arrangement of the Odyssey would have to put books 9 through 12 first, followed by books 5 through 8, followed by books 13 through 24, and the first four books, The Adventures of Telemachus, really don't fit at all. They take place in the same time frame as books 5 through 8, when Odysseus is traveling from Calypso's island to the land of the Phaeacians. Now, this extremely complex structure has struck some critics over the centuries as a blemish on the Odyssey, or even as an indication that the Odyssey is a not very skillfully assembled collection of shorter poems that somebody put together rather carelessly without really thinking much about what he was doing when he put it together. Other scholars, including me, think that the complex structure is on quite the opposite, is one of the great beauties and glories of the Odyssey, that it adds immeasurably to the Odyssey's power. One reason I think that, there are many, but one reason I think that is specifically because of the effect that's gained by delaying Odysseus's entry until book 5 of the Odyssey. Let's think about that a little bit. We do not see Odysseus for 4 full books. Instead, we go to Ithaca and see Odysseus's family and country in his absence. Odysseus has been gone for nearly 20 years at this point, and this has caused immeasurable problems, both for his wife and son and for his society. Let's start with his family. Of course, in any culture, one of the most heart-wrenchingly tragic things that can happen to a family is to have a member of that family be missing in action, to have someone go off to war, never return, and you don't know what happened to him. That is unutterably terrible for any family in any culture. But for Odysseus's family, in the culture portrayed by the Odyssey, it is even more terrible than perhaps would immediately be obvious to a modern audience. Penelope, Odysseus's wife, is caught between two absolutely conflicting duties with no way of knowing which one she should follow. If she is still a wife, it is her absolute unquestioned duty to remain loyal to her husband. If Odysseus is still alive, Penelope must protect his household, must not remarry, must keep his goods, his family, his home intact for him until he returns. This is a society in which there is no possibility of divorce in absentia, no way to have someone declared dead after a certain number of years have passed. Not that those are easy things to do, emotionally speaking, but they do at least allow someone in Penelope's situation to finish that episode of her life and figure what to do next. Penelope has no such possibility. Also, this is a culture, the culture of the Odyssey, that has no place for an unmarried woman. Penelope needs to be married. There is no role in this society for an independent, unmarried woman. So if Odysseus is still alive, Penelope's absolute, unquestionable duty is to remain loyal to him. On the other hand, if he is dead, since this is not a society that accepts unmarried women as contributing members of society, if Odysseus is dead, she has no less absolute a duty to remarry, to turn Odysseus's household over to her son Telemachus, and to go off with a new husband and make a new life elsewhere. So Penelope is caught in an agonizing dilemma. She has no way of knowing what her status is. Is she a wife or is she a widow? Her duty is absolutely clear either way, but those duties are absolutely conflicting, and she has no way of knowing which applies to her. Telemachus is in a similar situation, not knowing his status. Is he guarding the kingdom for his father, or is this his own kingdom and his own household that he should claim as a grown man for himself? And so Penelope and Telemachus are both left in a kind of limbo, in which their proper course of action is unclear, and in which they have no way to figure out what their proper course of action is. Odysseus's absence also causes great problems for his society. Like all the societies reflected in the Homeric epics, Ithaca is a monarchy. It seems never to have occurred to anyone on Ithaca that you could have any form of society except a monarchy. Ithaca, therefore, is a monarchy whose monarch has been missing for 20 years. And the disorder this causes in society is vast. There is no proper working of Ithacan society while its king is gone. The focal point for these troubles in both family and society are the suitors of Penelope, young men of Ithaca who are trying to marry Penelope and by so doing to take over Odysseus's household and take over the rule of Ithaca. These suitors assume that by marrying Penelope, they would be able, in fact, to take over the kingdom. That is, they assume that Telemachus is still so immature that he would not be able to stop them. And Telemachus, as the Odyssey opens, is very immature. He must be about 20 years old. He can't be any younger than that. And yet he has never yet asserted himself As an adult, he has never yet tried to put himself forward as a grown man in a position of authority. We'll talk more about Telemachus's maturity or lack of maturity in the next lecture. So the suitors are threatening Odysseus's marriage. We know that because we know that Odysseus is still alive. They're threatening Telemachus's inheritance and their wanton disregard of the proprieties. They force themselves into Telemachus's house. They destroy his goods and his livelihood. They bother Penelope, who doesn't want them around. They are very clearly not acting as suitors ought to act. Their wanton disregard of the proprieties can be seen as a result of the disordered state on Ithaca, or almost as a paradigm of the disordered state on Ithaca. So Homer starts the Odyssey not at some random moment, and the focusing on Telemachus for the first four books is not an unmotivated digression. Rather, Homer starts the Odyssey at the precise moment when the situation on Ithaca is coming to a head and something must give. Telemachus is now grown and should assert himself as master of his own household. While Telemachus was still a child, Penelope could put off any kind of decision about whether Odysseus was alive or dead by focusing on bringing Telemachus up. She was maintaining the household, if not for her husband, at least for her son. But now that Telemachus is grown, she should hand the household over to him, and if she is in fact a widow, she should remarry. Also, Penelope had managed to hold the suitors at bay for 3 years by telling them that before she could choose which one of them to marry, she needed to fulfill her final duty to her first marriage by weaving a burial shroud for her father-in-law, Laertes. Laertes is not yet dead, but Odysseus was an only son. There are no other daughters-in-law. Odysseus's mother is dead. So Penelope, in effect, said, let me discharge this final duty to my first marriage so that when Laertes dies, he can be properly buried. And of course, in her very famous weaving trick, she wove the shroud every day, unwove it at night, so it never got finished. This worked for 3 years. But then a maid of Penelope's told the suitors what she was doing. The suitors caught Penelope at the trick. That trick will not hold the suitors off any longer. Thus, we enter the scene, we start the Odyssey at the exact moment when the situation has become desperate. The suitors have seen through Penelope's trick. Telemachus is grown and should assert himself. Odysseus is needed back on Ithaca right now. In our next lecture, we'll look in more detail at the first four books of the Odyssey and at the treatment of Telemachus in those books.